Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. I'm your host, Stilly Sherilumbus, on the Daily Maverick Show. It's just gone 1 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon. I'm joined in studio by Simon Allison, a senior reporter at the Daily Maverick, and our first thing editor, John Stupart. Welcome, John. Your first visit to the studio.
Yeah.
First attendance on the show.
Yeah, it's quite cool to be here. Quite nice to see the Cliff Central studio as well. Very, very interesting.
Cool. I feel like I've got the brains trust of First Thing newsletter here. You know, both guys having served time, I think, is probably the best analogy we can use.
That sums it up, yeah.
You know, although, Simon, your time was slightly different, I believe, you know, well, it was at the end of your reign, you know, in your robe, drinking mojitos in Hong Kong, pushing it out in the afternoon as opposed to the morning grind session.
You know who really did it well, actually, was Simon Williamson. He was the editor before me. And I visited him once in New York, which is where he used to do it from. And he had to sort of, you know, send it through at about, it was 10 or 11 p.m. New York time. And he'd sit there with a bottle of wine and start the thing. And by the time he'd finished, the bottle of wine was also finished.
That's fantastic.
But you know what? It kind of worked.
It's that Hemingway adage of, you know, write drunk and edit sober, you know, which
exactly.
is what a proofreader's for, really, at the end of the day.
Well, yeah, if you speak to Richard Poblack, he'll tell you that the Hannibal Lecter series especially was a whole lot of credit has to go to Mr. Glenfiddich for helping him through that. If you're not familiar with the First Thing newsletter that goes out under the Daily Maverick brand in the mornings, you might also get it as part of the Cliff Central Daily Dose. Gets syndicated to the Cliff Central audience every morning as well. And the person pretty much responsible for that is John. And John, tell, you know, without this being a big PR piece for the newsletter, which is quite special and quite close to my heart.
Incredibly special.
Having given birth to it a couple times myself. tell us about what goes into putting that beast together every day.
It requires a fair amount of concentration, especially, I mean, obviously now I'm in South Africa, so you're getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, somewhat blurry-eyed, looking at the news, and then trying to figure out what's important, what hasn't been done yesterday, you know, before anyone goes to bed. And
this is after a whole lot of prep work's been done the night before.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, things like, you know, trying to get the weather sorted, and, you know, just basic sort of info set up. Trying to find witty quotes is a constant challenge, as well as, I mean, obviously the fact of the day is quite difficult. But then, obviously, in the morning, it's quite tough sometimes, because sometimes you'd be surprised how little there is newsworthy over the course of an evening, as the rest of South Africa, as the rest of the readers sleep.
To try and pick things that are newsworthy that don't involve death, destruction, and some kind of suicide bomb.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's
plenty of that, right?
there's no shortage of that. It's, I mean, Islamic State, as you know, I suppose we'll see in a bit. It's there's no shortage of that. I mean, there's some of the most depressing mornings I've had. You know, you have a beheading of a journalist, and there's a bombing here, and there's a strike here, and then a plane crash over here, and a volcano blows up somewhere else.
Mm. But don't forget to be funny, though, John.
But it's got to be funny, yeah. Although
suicide bombings are just a general
can be depressing, but above everything, make sure it's funny.
Yeah. So take us through. I mean, it's there's the quote. We start with the quote, and then a roundup of things that happened while you were sleeping.
Yes.
Some financial indicators. It's become quite a big publication, Simon. From the time you took it over, from Simon Williamson days, it's grown into, you know, a bit of a beast.
It is. I mean, what's the current readership figures, Dilly?
So I think when you took it over, it was sitting at around 11,000, if I'm not mistaken. And we managed to grow that quite nicely, and we would have this sort of 25% jump year on year, and we'd get excited about that. So it's now sitting at 27,000 at the Daily Maverick database.
Just on the Daily Maverick.
Just on the Daily Maverick. And then syndicated to another 40,000 Cliff Central listeners.
It's one of those things that it grows exponentially, doesn't it?
Yeah, the momentum.
It's very much a word of mouth publication, I think. People tell their friends to sign up. And the more people that are reading it, the more people are spreading that word.
Mm. And it's not just an algorithmically produced action script that runs at a particular time in the morning. It's something that...
Yeah, it's not a harvester of news. It's unless you count me as the harvester, I suppose. Well, I must admit, on those figures, I was a little disconcerted in July, sort of, as I started learning how to do the First Thing, you know, you start seeing that the number of subscribers slowly dwindling, and you think, oh, God, what's going wrong? What have I done? But now I'm happy to report we're back up to, you know, pre-John Stupart levels, which is good.
So one of the things that we do is we include a fact of the day, and we've extended that to the radio show. Today we've got a fact that we've kind of struggled to put into written word. And you'll see why, you know, once we start talking about it. So it's probably gone down as the strangest football game in the history of football. It was a 1994 Caribbean Cup qualification game. The background to the story is that Barbados were trailing Grenada by one goal point difference in the sort of qualification round. And they needed to win, obviously, by 2 points on goal difference to get through. And they were leading 2-0 in normal time. And Grenada scored a goal, and the score went to 2-1, which meant if the game ended as it was, Grenada would go through on points difference. So Barbados quickly realized that if they scored an own goal, the game would go to extra time. And in extra time, under these rules, if a golden goal is scored, it counts as 2 points. So what happened was Barbados scored an own goal. The score went to 2-2 with about 5 minutes left to play. But now Grenada realized what was going on, and they realized if they scored either an own goal or a goal, then there would be no extra time and Barbados wouldn't have the opportunity to try and get the golden goal, which would count as 2 points. So you had the situation where for the last 5 minutes of this game in normal time, Grenada were trying to score an own goal as well as a goal. And Barbados were defending both sets of goals, trying to prevent the own goal and the goal from occurring, which they did. And The game went into extra time. Barbados scored the goal, the golden goal, to get the 2 points and went ahead in the qualifying game ahead of Grenada.
That is fantastic.
I'm not quite sure what that says about Grenada's striking ability in the dying minutes of the game.
They couldn't score an own goal. Anyway, it goes down in history as one of the weirdest football matches, and you can probably see why we haven't been able to put this into written word. Well, in anything, you know, under 2 pages long.
You know, people would describe that as unsportsmanlike, but I got to disagree. I think if you know the rules and you know.
It's strategic.
It's strategic. Yeah. It's clever. To bend the rules to your favor, you got to play according to the set of rules. That's the only thing you can do.
Well, it's like that famous cricket game, Australia versus New Zealand, where New Zealand needed a six off the last ball, and who was it? One of the famous Australian bowlers bowled it underhand because you can't hit it. You rolled it along the ground to the New Zealand batsman, and you can't hit that for six. And has gone down as one of the most unsportsmanlike,
douchiest cricket moves ever.
And probably added to the Australians, the perception of most Australians after that, or the dislike of, especially on the sports field. So, okay, moving on to the real news. Simon, the Mo Ibrahim Foundation Index was released, when was it, on Monday?
Yes,
you used to do some work at the Mo Ibrahim Foundation.
I did 2.5 years at the Mo Ibrahim Foundation in their communications department. I enjoy the foundation, but I hated communications, I have to say. It really doesn't matter what
you're
selling.
Are you aware of the irony?
There's corporate communications.
There's two sides of the fence because corporate communications, whether you're selling African governance or, bauxite, it's the same thing. You really are doing exactly the same things, using the same strategies.
Just spinning a different flavor of bullshit.
And I don't like spinning things. I like to be able to say things the way I want to say things. And rather than spin things, just call out other people's spin. That's far more enjoyable. So it didn't last long. But it did give me my enduring love of all things African and political. So it did pay off. But now this index is interesting. And it's actually the Mo Ibrahim Foundation does two things. They give this prize for presidents. Huge cash money every year.
Well, if
they can find a president, but they often struggle. But actually, that's not really what Mo Ibrahim himself cares about. The prize is kind of a side thing. His real passion is this index, and it's a collection of sort of 90,000 data points. They get statistics from every African country, except Sudan and South Sudan, because they now split, which has completely messed with all the data. So they've left those out for the last couple iterations. But they collect all this data, and then they sort of crunch it for us. They put it into their algorithms, and it spits out these rankings. across different categories and, of course, an overall ranking, looking at how well is your country governed? Where does it fit into the rest of Africa in terms of governance? And then the subcategories are things like rule of law, safety, human rights, sustainable economic opportunity, those kinds of things. So look, it's a very imperfect tool, partly because data in Africa is immensely flawed. A lot of it doesn't exist. A lot of it has just been carried over year on year. So you're looking at some of the poverty statistics that are used to make decisions today actually come from 1993 and haven't been updated since then. It's quite horrendous. But so it's a
kind of like Nigeria's
exactly.
GDP.
Well,
right?
This is a perfect example. The GDP can suddenly jump. What is it? 40% overnight, because the data hasn't been looked at properly. It hasn't been collected properly. And that's GDP. That's probably the single most important statistic that a country has in terms of, you know,
possibly one of the easiest ones to collect as well.
You would think,
relatively
so.
Speaking.
Relatively, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so if GDP can vary by as much as 40% in somewhere like Nigeria, when Nigeria, you know, it is relatively
It's the biggest economy in Africa.
It's the biggest economy in Africa. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of interest. So what about these other statistics like, you know, literacy rates, education rates? Governments, bear in mind, governments are not incentivized to monitor their own poor progress in any of those things.
And some of these are less qualitative in nature as well, which probably makes them harder to collect.
Well, this is another problem. I can't remember the exact ratio, but a decent proportion of the data is based on survey data, it's called, which is pretty common. But the problem is, who's doing the survey data? And we're not talking survey data going out in the streets and asking a selection of people in Nigeria what they think of their government. We're talking some guy sitting in the Economist Intelligence Unit's office, and I think it's in Brussels or somewhere. He is the sort of so-called, air quotes, expert on Africa, and then he assigns a number. You know, I think human rights in Burkina Faso is a 7 this year, because, you know, I read 2 reports that said they beat up protesters. That's pretty much the level.
Yeah, all my bonuses linked to this number. Let me,
exactly.
I think I deserve a 7.
And it also gets compounded as well, where that expert in Brussels will sit there and say, I've done this for 5 years based on a flawed model that I've been given when I arrived. Mm-hmm. And now, while I see there's a, you know, 7-point change or something like that over since last year.
Your base might be so far out of whack.
Exactly.
I mean, a rubbish number.
Exactly. So yes, we've got to bear in mind these statistics are problematic. But having said that, and given the sort of volume of the stuff they collect, you do get a sort of approximate picture. And it's interesting. It is interesting. South Africa comes in at number 4.
In terms of the best governed country in Africa, we're sitting at number 4.
We're sitting at number 4. Ahead of us,
where were we last year?
Son? We were 5, I think. So we've gone up 1.
Ahead.
I think. I need to check that.
Yeah.
But you know, we sort of occupy that 4 or 5 position.
They obviously don't read Daily Maverick.
Yeah, we could give them some survey data if they asked. But so ahead of us is Botswana and a couple of the island nations. But what was interesting this year was all of the top 5 have actually had one area in which they have backslid significantly. And for South Africa, it's our main problem area, and it's no surprise, it's safety and the rule of law. And I think that meshes certainly with what we've been covering at the Daily Maverick.
Mm-hmm. And if you think of it, that's probably... it's almost definitely not going to take into account the latest crime statistics that came out.
No, it'll be even worse.
It'll be even worse next time this report runs.
You exactly.
know, I mean, the truer picture is a lot worse.
So that's South Africa. More generally, there are a couple of other interesting trends. One is that they have one category which measures wars between countries. And this year, the foundation said there are no wars between countries in Africa anymore.
That's great. There we go. Problem solved.
So, civil wars are different.
So that's domestic conflict.
Yeah.
But in terms of, you know, people taking up arms against other countries, that I can't really think of any. The only ones that spring to mind would be the sort of African intervention in Somalia, but that has been done under a continental mandate, which changes things. They're a peacekeeping mission as opposed to a war, an invasion. So that's interesting, and I think that's probably pretty good. You know,
although does that include isolated incidents, for example? say, Rwanda lobbing mortar shells into the DRC last year, for example, or something
well,
like that.
Did they or didn't they? Rwanda would deny that vociferously.
Come on now, come on. Yeah. But, I mean, things like, I mean, if it's,
yeah,
how many troops is an invasion? Or,
that's a good question.
Yeah, know, and then meeting the definition of a war, right?
Exactly.
What is the definition of a war?
I think you have to formally declare, I think there's paperwork involved. Lawyers. Much like anything else in life, really.
Lawyers, accountants.
Yeah.
It seems like it's in someone's interest not to declare a war. If you're actually going to go to war.
You just sort of do it.
It probably just opens you up to a whole pile of crap, right? You know, the UN and, you know, AU and all
especially
sorts of
these days,
you know.
Yeah. But I mean, I just wonder with that, you know, talking about sort of inter, you know, cross-border warfare or things like that. Yeah, I mean, you have sort of Rwanda lobbing shells across, or allegedly lobbing shells across the border. You know, that was a fairly brazen act of aggression if it was Rwanda. Which, you know, all indications indicate that it was.
If it flies from Rwanda and smells like Rwanda.
That wouldn't have made it into this year's data set.
Oh, is it? So it was...
Because there's normally a two-year lag on these kinds of things.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Which is...
Then in 2 years' time...
In 2 years, if it comes up, we'll be watching closely.
But, Sam, the overriding sort of sentiment was, you know, reading your piece was... you in the top five don't think you're doing anything special. You guys are actually slipping.
Yes.
You're going backwards. So don't pat yourselves on the back because you made the top five.
What did Mo Ibrahim say? He said, brothers, watch it. It doesn't mean you're very good or you are perfect. there are some slippages happening here. So, yes, overall, if you look at the big number and you look at it over the last 10 years, because that's the kind of data they collect data over 10 years and they're constantly updating that data. So this year's index has a full 10-year data set for you to examine. And overall governance improves by about 1% maybe over the last 5 to 10 years.
For the continent.
For the continent. Now, the thing is, which this is sort of inside information that I happen to know that they did not choose to publish this year, was that this is well inside the margins of error of the index. and because the data is so poor, the margins of error are huge.
Mm, yeah.
So actually, a lot of these numbers, you know, the small numbers, you're talking about people improving and they've only gone up by 1 or 2 points on the index. Mm. It's meaningless, completely meaningless.
Sunshine journalism, sunshine communications.
Yeah, exactly. See why I wanted to be on the other side of the divide.
Yeah. Sam, the presidential award, was that supposed to be announced at the same time? Is it is it usually released at the same time as the index?
You're bringing out all the skeletons, hastily. When I was there, we separated it. So the prize and the index were two different things, different announcements, and then. As I was leaving, they brought them together. And the reason that they brought them together was that they kept not having a prize winner.
Mm-hmm. So you can't have this big event and go,
there's no prize. So like, at least they could say, oh, there's no prize, but we have this index which shows that governance is improving in Africa.
By 1%.
Yeah, look at this. Yeah. Look at this shiny thing
exactly.
on the left.
this year, they did that for, I think, 3 or 4 years. This year, they elected to separate it again. And I'm pretty sure it's because, A, there's no... prize winner. There's not going to be another prize winner. There's no one that I can think of that'll qualify this year. And B, the index is not particularly good news either. So it would have been a very unhappy press conference all around.
So you think that they will split it, or they are going to split it, but they won't announce the winner again this year. I mean, that's still quite strange, though. I mean, just to have that you know, event and announcement of nothing, basically, or it's not nothing. There's no award. I mean, that goes to say a lot, really.
What the foundation says, and what Mo Ibrahim says to his credit, is he says it's just as important to know when there isn't a winner mm-hmm. as when there is. Because when there isn't a winner, then we have to ask ourselves, what are we doing wrong?
Mm-hmm.
He says he's not here for the sunshine narrative. He's here to try and reflect a mirror onto the state of governance in Africa. And part of that is putting your hand up and saying, well, there's no one that deserves this.
Who was the last recipient?
The last recipient was, I forget his name, I think President Pires of Cape Verde.
Right, and they're in the top five, aren't they?
They are in the top five.
That was several years ago, wasn't it?
That was 2011.
Right.
Yeah, look, I've done tests with them, and I've done them subsequently, where you look at other continents. Let's take Europe. It's a continent, I think, think we know relatively well. Who would you give it to this year? So bear in mind the conditions. It has to be a president who was elected constitutionally, left office, you know, within his term limits or her term limits, you know, did everything the right way. Then they had to, while in office, they really had to have been exceptional. We're not talking about good. We're not talking about decent. We're talking about someone who really is the epitome of what a good leader should be. And I got to say, no one springs to mind in Europe.
Well, I can't think of anyone.
At a global level, you'd probably Jay Nidy wrote about him as a president he would vote for in, was it Paraguay or something, where he still drives an old
Beetle. He's still in office, so he's not eligible.
Yeah.
I would say, I mean, it's a shame the Scottish referendum went this way, because I think if it swung the other way, that would certainly be an impressive feat of governance by the Scots. But barring them, I can't think of anyone, at least off the top of my head.
Cool. All right. John, I mean, we've touched on a couple of sort of war-type arguments and debates and issues. And obviously your background as a defense journalist has obviously come in handy in a couple of situations. Tell us a little bit more about what you do at the African Defense Review.
The African Defense Review is my little baby that I sort of started as I was going into the UK to study at King's College to do a war studies master's degree, to basically, or literally I should say, be a master of war. And there, you know, I started this website with a few colleagues of mine based in South Africa, based in Europe, based in other parts of Africa, because we felt we had some pretty good contacts that we could actually do some analysis on very specific crises, which is where we sort of started doing the DRC with the Force Intervention Brigade last year in August, which is where we were able to actually provide quite a lot of, I like to think, useful information. I haven't gotten accounts from friends of mine who work in the United Nations in the DRC, who actually, their friends have said, there's this great website you got to see for Congolese information. It's called African Defense Review. And I thought that was pretty cool. So that's certainly my formal start, I suppose. Before that, I've always been interested in war, always been fascinated with sort of military history and things like that. I did a brief stint at a local defense journal as well as a deputy editor, where I worked under a very, very old chap by the name of, we called him Mr. Mac, who, you know, those in the defense fraternity would at least know of him. He's a sort of 86-year-old man who would run me ragged coming back and forth from Pretoria and Johannesburg. So that's where I sort of came from. I've just come back from London now, finishing my master's, looking mostly at South African defense policy and how it can be improved, hopefully.
I guess if we're talking war and wartime issues, there's probably nothing bigger on the radar than ISIS, ISIL, IS.
Daesh.
Yeah. Okay. First of all, what's up with the name?
Names.
Yeah, you've got like different people choosing different variations. Have they undergone a brand, you know, brand redesign, repositioning themselves? What's up with that?
I think that's what's very interesting about ISIS, ISIL, Daesh, ISIS, IS, Islamic State, is that they are somewhat conscious of their brand, which is why, for example, Daesh, which is the Arabic name for their organization, is somewhat discouraged, at least by the terrorists themselves, simply because apparently it's very similar to an Arabic translation of being trampled upon, which I can understand if you want to.
That sound apt, though.
Yeah, I mean, nowadays it's a pretty good term for them. But the other names, ISIL is the Islamic State in Levant, originates, if I remember correctly, and Simon, please correct me if I'm wrong here, originates from Iraq, from their sort of original splitting, as I understand it, from Al-Qaeda in Iraq when they were sort of under the yoke of al-Zarqawi before he was killed. But what you need to understand is, for the most part, these names all translate to the same thing. Islamic State generally prefer to be referred to as Islamic State, because then it doesn't confine themselves to a border. It sort of implies a broader regional control, which you know, there's an argument to be made that maybe that's exactly what they're doing right now.
And that obviously ties in with the declaration of the caliphate.
Those came. They changed their name from ISIS, ISIL. ISIS and ISIL mean exactly the same thing. Yeah. They're just two different English translations. Either Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, or Islamic State in Iraq and the Shams, which is the Arabic word for that kind of for that region. So they've changed their name to the Islamic State, which is quite an amazing claim to make. You know, they're not describing a geographical territory. They are sort of this amorphous.
They're describing a historical empire that used to exist. Yeah.
Coupling that with this idea of the caliphate, and the caliphate, by declaring a caliphate, what you are doing is you are telling all Muslims that they are now subservient to you. But this caliphate has been established, and you now need to, you know, give your be submissive towards the caliph himself, which
the equivalent of your Middle Eastern Vatican is now up for shop.
Yes,
Old Baghdadi kind of like is now
a second coming kind of there's a new leader in town kind of thing, and then everyone must bow.
There is, and the interesting thing is, I mean, there is already. I mean, there are lots of echoes of the caliphate already in the Middle East. The ruling family in Bahrain are the Khalifas, and Khalifa is the Arabic for caliphate. One of the titles of the Saudi king is caliph. So he's, you know, already you have this contestation. Mm-hmm. That's perhaps why the Saudis are so worried, and they're contributing to the
absolutely
to the U.S. forces that are bombing the Islamic State, because they're really worried that actually this idea of a caliphate, declaring it, you know, it's not really about the world's Muslims, although that would be the end goal, but it's about antagonizing the other entities that lay claim to leading the Muslim world. And in particular, those are Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda has long dreamed of establishing its own caliphate.
That was always its original plan.
Yeah, exactly. It's never had the territory. It's never had the political power to do so. And maybe it's never had the balls to do so. What we're seeing, you know, the Islamic State is just going ahead and doing it. And that's part of the Islamic State's attraction to many young jihadis, and why they are suddenly attracting all these Africans and Europeans, Central Asians, etc., to their ranks. Mm. The other person that is threatened by this is Saudi, because Saudi is the sort of official leader of the Muslim world. Saudi, of course, the two holy cities, Mecca and Medina, are in Saudi, and the Saudi king is the official custodian of the two holy cities. He's not doing a great job, to be honest. Lots of reports of the incredible development around Mecca, you know, these ancient tombs being destroyed to make way for a shiny plastic skyscraper.
Can you imagine shopping if Israelis build a condo next to the Wailing Wall or something like that?
So it would be shopping malls with the indoor skiing slopes,
exactly.
Ski slopes, right?
Exactly. That's clearly what Muhammad would have wanted. Mm-hmm. At least that's the Saudi interpretation.
I'm just reading here that the Levant region includes Jordan, Israel, Palestine, Lebanon, parts of southern Turkey, and Cyprus. So I'm just sending off a mail to my family to tell them to
pack
up and
watch out for a couple of black-clothed guys. flowing robes, run.
South Africa is safer after all. That's the message.
Yeah. So where did these guys come from? So we know they broke out of Al-Qaeda, basically now making Al-Qaeda look like a bunch of sissies, essentially.
Yeah. Although they, ironically, I mean, the Al-Qaeda tended to distance themselves from the ISIL group before there was this giant split, simply because their tactics were considered far too barbaric and far too violent for Al-Qaeda's taste. Because bear in mind, Al-Qaeda is, they get it. They understand global media, particularly after the initial beheadings of Daniel Pearl and things like that, you know, talking many, many years back now. Al-Qaeda understood how to manage its popularity as a global terrorist brand, I dare say. Whereas ISIL, as you say, have got the balls to simply say, fuck it, we're just gonna behead, chop heads off. You know, if you're not Sunni, that's it, tough. You're going to die. And I think with Al-Qaeda, they simply almost sort of held ISIL under its sort of control through Zarqawi before he was knocked off. Zarqawi was the chap who kind of looked like a ninja with a machine gun, a couple of sort of propaganda videos of him running around Iraq.
Crazy bastard.
Yeah, he was a madman. Yeah. Absolutely crazy. Osama bin Laden apparently told him to like chill out a bit because he was being a little crazy in Iraq.
They didn't like each other at all.
No, absolutely.
Zarqawi and bin Laden. A very difficult relationship there. Zarqawi spearheaded the whole resistance to the American occupation of Iraq. All those IEDs and car bombs and suicide attacks. I mean, there was that spate in sort of 06, 07, 08 in Iraq where it was so incredibly bloody.
Mm.
And that was Zarqawi.
The Hurt Locker.
The Hurt Locker, exactly. It was that phase. It was Zarqawi and his successes, but he really laid the blueprint. Then what the Americans did, and this was brilliant, was they managed to sort of co-opt a bunch of other Sunni militant groups into a kind of
surge.
Coalition called the Awakening.
Yeah.
And it was, they talk about the surge, and that was the U.S. military component.
Mm.
And that,
but it incorporated the whole Awakening as well, yeah.
But it was really, it was using Sunni groups against another Sunni group that was where it was effective because they could reach places that American troops simply could not go. They understood how things worked in a way that the Americans simply couldn't. And that really sort of put the lid on Zarqawi's group. And then the Americans left. And then Syria happened. And Syria was really the sort of kick-starting factor to get it all going again, because what happened was this Iraqi group, an offshoot of Al-Qaeda, said, look, we should get involved in Syria. This is ripe territory for us.
There's a vacuum here, right?
Exactly. And initially, if you remember, Syria was part of the Arab Spring. It was a pro-democracy movement. It was a very secular opposition that wanted to bring in democratic values. And slowly that opposition got kind of subverted. It still exists, but it's much less powerful because the powerful groups in Syria now, the opposition groups, are the Islamist groups. What happened, though, was that ISIS, who knows what it was then? Islamic State of Iraq is what it was then, sent one of their members to set up a group called Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Nusra Front.
Mm.
And they were, their first representatives, and they did a great job, and they got very powerful very quickly. And then the guy who was sent to lead the Nusra Front thought, hey, I'm not sure I want to take orders from these guys in Iraq anymore. I'm kind of going to go it alone.
Things are going all right in Syria. Yeah, exactly. Why not, you know?
So then the guys in Iraq said, okay, well, we're going to forget about you and we're going to start up again. And they sent another bunch of guys over to start the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. And that was the real genesis of ISIS as we know it today. And then there was this war between Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS. So these two Islamist groups, started by the same people, basically, were now fighting amongst themselves and fighting the Syrian government at the same time. I mean, it really is quite a military feat.
It's a giant hot mess, I believe, is the term I used to call it. I mean, even before IS came onto the radar, Syria was not a great place in terms of its civil war. It was just a giant chaotic mess, and there was no... It was the definition of a sort of strategic quagmire for everybody involved, which is probably why until now America wouldn't get involved, even when there was this explicit exposure of chemical weapons being used by the Syrian government. And I think now it became this incredibly complicated mess. You had incredibly open and porous borders by virtue of the fact that the Syrian government simply couldn't control its own state, which meant you could just have more and more terrorist groups and sort of rebel movements popping up, moving in, jihadists coming across the border constantly. And that creates or just exacerbates the problem even more, which is at least a large part of how this whole thing.
Do we know how big the force of the Islamic State is, the people, actually the fighters involved? There seems to be a huge discrepancy in the number of people. Anything from like 20,000 to 100,000 armed people.
The last estimate I heard was about 30,000 actual people with machine guns and assault rifles, kinds of terrorists running around.
And and it's quite scary to think. So I was reading up about Tikrit, which fell to IS or ISIS about 4 months ago, and it's not a big city. not a big stronghold. And the Iraqi army was sent in to recapture Tikrit. And with tanks and helicopters and all the, you know, fancy military hardware that $100 billion of funding over the last 10 years can buy you. Mm. And they still haven't managed to reclaim this little town, well, which kind of shows you, you know, what you're up against, and B, maybe the incompetency of the Iraqi army at the moment.
There's definitely an element of incompetence, but we can't underestimate IS. I mean, the resources they now have, much of it captured from the Iraqi army, are huge. Apparently, they've got dozens of helicopters. They have something like 50,000 rounds of artillery shells or something. They've also,
tanks,
I heard
APCs,
this recently, tanks, APCs,
everything they
fighter
need.
Jets.
Well, whether or not they know how to fly and maintain them is...
Well, interestingly, I heard they didn't come from the Iraqi army.
Oh, right.
They came from Libya.
Interesting.
And
because they've done some
fighting,
haven't they?
I'm not too sure how that works.
Well, there are arms shipments coming in and out of, I think it's Misrata, which is, you've been following Libya far more closely than me. That's where there's been a lot of unrest in and around the port area there by a rogue general fighting against these arms shipments coming in and out of Libya. So it's I can certainly believe it.
Mm. Simon, haven't they sent guys over there to go and support some of the militia in Libya?
Yes. This was in late June. In late June, the sort of head honchos of the Islamic State got together and said, look, we see there's an Islamist group fighting in Libya. We should help them. So they sent back their... you know, anywhere between 500 and 1,000 Libyan fighters who were in Iraq and Syria fighting for the Islamic State. They rounded them up and said, look, you guys are going to go home and you're going to join the ranks of Ansar al-Sharia, who are fighting in and around Benghazi, which is the main eastern port city. Mm. And you're going to help them. And they said, okay. They went. And within the space of 2 weeks, most of Benghazi had fallen to Ansar al-Sharia. And Ansar al-Sharia had declared Benghazi to be an Islamic emirate. Mm-hmm. Now, this is quite an astonishing show of strength that you know, one decision made in some cave in Iraq can cause territory to fall in Libya, however many thousands of
And they probably picked up a couple of fighter planes there for their efforts as well.
You'd think so.
The age of globalized terrorism, truly terrifying, I think.
So now these guys are well funded. They're self-funded funding at the moment. They don't need to rely on external parties to fund. They've got something like $2 billion in the bank. I don't know which bank.
It's an estimated value of $2 billion.
Yeah.
No one knows how much of that is liquid. A lot of that is like military assets. Mm-hmm. That contribute to that valuation. But they still have lots of money.
Yeah, lots of money. I mean, I think something like $8 million a month comes in from the sale of black market oil.
$3 million a day. Steve.
A day. Wow. I think maybe... Geez,
that's all right.
Probably looking at the wrong number, the net profit number. Which is crazy, as well as ransom money. There's ransom money coming in. And something which was quite interesting to see is they now control 40% of the wheat production in Iraq.
I didn't know that figure.
Yeah, and which means that the stronghold or the grip that they have over the country is just getting bigger and bigger. I mean, they're starting to control the food supply and then things like cement factories and stuff. So they're going in and also forcing things like people to pay protection tax and the normal sort of shaking up of the public that you know, these kinds of organizations
do. Well, they've been very careful. So if you contrast the Islamic State's occupation with America's occupation of Iraq. Now, America went in and basically decimated the civil service, the army,
disbanded the government.
Basically, there was nothing left.
Yeah.
You know, you had people, I remember I read a great book, The Green Zone, I think it was called, and you had people, you know, young corporals from Missouri, age 22, being flown in to create a new road law for Iraq because they couldn't find the old one. Crazy things like this. What the Islamic State has done so well is they've moved in very carefully. They have taken care to protect any kinds of assets. So, you know, the fields, the power stations, the dams, and to keep them running. So
they're also functioning courts of law,
yes.
Theoretically, you know, Sharia courts and things like that are operating within their, you know, in Raqqa, I think specifically they have. Yeah, there is a semblance of civil society going on, albeit the ISIS way.
And it's one of those questions. It's a pretty hardline government, but Would you prefer a hardline government to no government at all, which is kind of what a lot of these people were facing otherwise?
So the question then moves on, how do you fight something like ISIS? You know, if you look at, you know, the main opposition or the adversaries that they face, Syria, USA, and obviously Iran, who are supporting the Iraqi government, it's not likely you're going to get a coalition out of those three quite soon. That's going to be an effective coalition where there will be goodwill and work, you know, good working relationship between the three of them. So, you know, how do you fight? How do you combat something like ISIS now that is getting stronger and stronger by the day, well, and claiming more and more territory?
I mean, you've just by talking about all these assets and these sort of structures that IS has actually started establishing, therein lies the key to their defeat, I would say. I'm going to put on my sort of master of war hat now and start, you know, I'm not going to draw diagrams or anything like that. But the more territory and the more assets they control, the more visible they become to U.S. air forces, to Iraqi ground forces who are now supported by the USA. And to an extent, there are some Arab coalition forces also getting on board. But I mean, you're right, it is certainly divided. I mean, it's very difficult in the best of days to get a, you know, to get a Sunni government to ally with a Shia government to fight a Sunni terrorist group, for example. But the more tanks and the larger formations that IS move in and the more jihadists who flow in, the more targets, quite frankly, there are for U.S. Air Force planners to actually allocate and designate and, you know, destroy. And I think I actually wrote about it today in today's first thing, is talking about how Islamic State is now adapting its tactics. They're starting to spread out. They're starting to abandon their heavy weapons. And that shows, okay, it's a remarkable adaptability, but, you know, obviously it's an insurgency for all intents and purposes. They're going to adapt. It's this organic mess that the Americans have to try and somehow deprive of its operational environment. What you can do is by forcing to spread out, is you're eliminating their offensive capability, which means the next time they come at something like Mosul Dam, for example, or their next target, they're going to come in far fewer numbers and in far greater strength with far less sophisticated military tactics, which then potentially, and I cannot stress potentially enough, could enable the Iraqi forces allied with the USA, I'm talking in the Iraq context here specifically, it could allow them to actually repel these attacks, particularly, I mean, the Kurds as well. I have full confidence in their ability to protect their homeland, as it were. And I think in Syria, you might see a similar kind of scenario where you have more and more obvious targets being eliminated, and you start getting this diffuse mass, which does, to an extent, I would say, play into the hands of the USA and the counter-terror forces, simply because it's a lot harder to run a civil society when you can't operate your security forces in there and thus maintain control of your city.
You mentioned America as part of the counter-terrorism coalition, and it's staggering to think that Barack Obama is now the fourth consecutive president to authorize bombing of Iraqi targets.
It's almost like a tradition now.
Yeah.
Welcome to the presidency. Here's your airstrike coordinates.
And given that, you know, at the start of all, at the start of his tenure, or in the build up to the start of his tenure, you know, his intentions were to decrease American presence in the Middle East. And, you know, we're now going full circle and, you know,
we're leaving Iraq, we're leaving Afghanistan, we're going to disengage. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's astonishing that the lessons haven't been learned, though. The news came in yesterday that Jabhat al-Nusra, the Nusra Front, so these were the enemies of Islamic State, that fighting between them was such a problem they had to call in al-Qaeda to adjudicate. This was how bad it got.
You know you're in trouble when al-Qaeda has to mediate
is the referee.
Exactly. Good grief.
Nusra Front.
It's like getting your brother the pyrotechnic to help out with the cooking for dinner. That's just ridiculous.
Exactly. But now Nusra Front, because of the American bombings, is going back in with the Islamic State. They're saying we can't afford to maintain these ideological differences in the face of an American onslaught. That worries me. It worries me greatly, because the only way you're going to really bring down the Islamic State is from within, is to have groups that have the legitimacy to tackle the Islamic State, that can provide a genuine alternative. And on this front, even though this is where you get into shades of relativity, where you'd prefer having Al Qaeda wandering around than the Islamic State.
The devil you know than the devil you don't.
You know, the clue in how to defeat ISIS comes in the surge and the awakening. It's using Sunni militant groups against another Sunni militant group, which is essentially what the Islamic State is. Instead, what's happening now is by America bombing and bringing in, I mean, these ridiculous partners, Saudi Arabia, they're like, oh yeah, the Arabs are with us. They're like, but the Arabs are the problem. Saudi Arabia is the enemy. It's enemy number one.
Yeah.
You know, if you were to go to Baghdadi today and you said, do you want to assassinate Barack Obama or the Saudi king? He'd choose the Saudi king. Now, it reveals this fundamental misunderstanding of how things work. It's what America is doing now is a PR battle.
I disagree with you on that. I would say there's actually there is something of a moral obligation going on here where the America must pursue its foreign policy, and its foreign policy is democracy and prevention of human rights, along with key allies. I agree 100% on the Arab allies being more of a problem than a solution. That said, I don't know what else America can do, and I think this ties in very firmly with its global whack-a-mole counter-terror strategy that it has adopted these days, which is it's really the only thing it can do, simply because the world is sick of America getting involved on the ground, at any rate, in the world's wars. But at the same time, we as the media are particularly guilty of this, when journalists were getting their heads chopped off 2 months ago, people were saying somebody should do something about this. This is terrible. This is a global threat. We should do something.
Which is exactly what the Islamic State wanted. It's so incredibly obvious. they just knock off, cut a foreigner's head off, and suddenly
foreign journalist, a giant, violent reaction.
And they knew this was coming. So you got to ask yourself, did they want it to come? Is this playing into their hands? And I think it is. And I don't buy your democracy argument, John. That's bullshit. If they were, no.
I firmly believe there is some element of neoliberalism going on here.
Why is one of America's key allies, Saudi Arabia, which is the Islamic State?
I'm not saying it's entirely pro-democracy. Don't get me wrong.
There is no difference between Saudi Arabia and the Islamic State.
For you.
Me.
Okay.
So if that's your, if you're going in for on grounds of democracy, human rights, freedom of religion, or whatever the fuck, then it doesn't make any sense to ally with one of the biggest abusers of all those things.
Well, yeah, because it's not like the Saudis aren't beheading people anyway.
Exactly.
Certainly. But at the same time, Saudi citizens can pay tax, they can travel outside of their borders. And I do think you need to draw a line where you have rampant
Saudi men can
leave the board.
Women can do.
Okay, so half of Saudi Arabia can leave, which is that's a hell of a lot more than Syria. But the bottom line is here, there is something of a moral imperative here that needs to be enforced. And whether it's America, whether it's Saudi Arabia, I honestly don't give a shit. Whoever gets involved there needs to get involved, and it needs to be
Sometimes it's braver to do nothing.
How do you think that would play out?
How I think that would play out is I think IS would overstretch themselves. They'd take a lot of territory very quickly. And you know what? If they want to set up an Islamic State...
No, but then you're saying you're going to end up with a civil war again, but this time not in Syria. You're going to have Syria and the Iraq. Region. You're going to have an explosion of the region again. And I don't think that's a particularly good long-term solution. I'm not saying whack-a-mole is a particularly good long-term solution either, but I do think it's a better solution than simply letting the fire burn, Because I don't think the fire will burn out, as it were. I don't think it's going to simply...
Brooks Spector had a great piece yesterday, I think, proposing something completely different. And
As he would.
As he would. And I got to say, it weirdly makes a lot of sense to me. He said... in the Iraq War, they did the calculations, and it cost something in the region of $30 million to kill every Viet Cong, or whichever Viet it was, Viet Minh soldier that they killed.
Viet Cong, too.
Was it Viet Cong? I get confused.
Sorry, how much?
Discrimination.
Something
was
like $30 million
per soldier.
Per soldier.
Okay.
Because the war is so expensive. Yeah.
Toilet paper and food and ammunition and water
and then probably
and fuel.
So what Brooks said was fuck it.
Take that money.
Take that money and say to all the Vietnamese who want to, say, well, come. You know, say to all the people that are currently fleeing Islamic State territory, and you know what? They are being allowed to leave. People are generally being allowed to leave, particularly Christians. There's no problem with Christians leaving.
There's even a Christian part of the court, actually, in Raqqa.
I didn't know that.
It's empty, but it's ostensibly functional.
You know, so basically, give the refugees somewhere to go. Take that $30 million, and I imagine it would be even more these days. Build them a house in America. Put it out with flat screens.
See, now that's a great idea, but now if that happened in the Middle East, for example, what happens next? I would want that. I want $30 million. I want to be able to do that. I'm going to start my own insurgency and get $30 million. It just incentivizes the spill-on effect. Which
maybe
I
we
don't
could
think
dress
is...
up the EFF to kind of give us a rebrand the EFF and we could get $30 million. Guys, it's been an incredible conversation to have you guys both here. I love the argy-bargy at the end there. We definitely need more of that.
All we need to conclude is that Simon's wrong. And
too
I'm
many,
right.
too many damn it. Daily Mavericks will think alike. I love it. That's been the Daily Maverick Show. I've been with Simon Allison and John Stupod. Guys, thank you so much for being in studio with me. If you didn't catch us live, you probably wouldn't be listening to this right now, but catch the podcast on Daily Maverick or Cliff Central. It'll be up this afternoon, Tuesday, and we look forward to seeing you again next week. Thanks.
The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com.